Food Today, science-based information on food, nutrition and safety. From UFIC, the European Food Information Council. In May 2012, experts from around the world gathered in Lyon for the 19th European Congress on Obesity. Global rates of obesity are rising rapidly, making the management and prevention of obesity and obesity-related disorders a top priority for government and public health initiatives. The programme drew over 2,500 participants from more than 80 countries and covered a range of obesity-related topics, including environment and prevention, genes, and clinical practice and management. A topic which was widely discussed at the ECO conference was appetite. Jason Halford, Professor of Psychology at the University of Liverpool in the UK, has discovered differences in appetite behaviour between people who are normal weight and people who are obese. We asked him to tell us a bit more about his research in this area.
I focused particularly on trying to understand the expression of appetite behaviour in the obese, the fact that the obese tend not to show the slowing of eating rate during a meal, which suggests that normal physiological feedback during the meal is not working sufficiently well, and also looking at between meal experiences of appetite. But what we also focused on was what we would call the hedonic aspects of appetite, and particularly in the obese, the fact that they tend to over-respond to food cues. Now, we all respond to food cues, particularly in a hungry state, but in the obese, even in a sated state, they will be more likely to be provoked to consume by external food cues. And those food cues could be the presence of food, they could be food adverts, they could be the eating environment or the situation that they find themselves in.
You talked in your presentation about the impact of caloric restriction on people's ability to manage their weight. What's the evidence in this area?
Reducing your intake is a difficult thing to do, otherwise we wouldn't be here. There wouldn't need to be an obesity congress. But the critical thing here is understanding the psychology of deprivation and the physiological consequences of energy restriction. I considered some data demonstrating that if you put people on a very low-calorie diet, you actually reduce the responsiveness of satiety hormones, so their basal levels are lower, and also their responsiveness to ingestion is lower. Conversely, hormones such as ghrelin associated with increased food intake, their levels rose. And that was quite an interesting thing, but not all that new. We've seen that in other studies. But the study that I discussed, the interesting thing about it was that these changes in appetite responses were still evident a year later, well after the intervention had taken place.
You mentioned the Minnesota starvation study in your talk. Can you explain a little bit about your research?
It's a very interesting study because it demonstrates the psychological consequences of energy restriction. And we see those whether it's normal weight volunteers, whether it's obese people, or whether it's normal dieters. We pretty much see the same psychological reactions. We see increased obsessions with food, we see a worsening of mood, we see an inability to concentrate. And all those were seen during the Minnesota study. But again, what was interesting is even when the individuals had regained weight, we saw some of the same psychological apparitions. So the psychology, like the physiology, there are long-term consequences to rapid weight loss through energy restriction.
Xavier Allirault is a PhD student from Lyon, France, who studied the effect of greater eating frequency on appetite control. What research question did you try to answer?
Basically, we were interested in understanding what is the effect of eating smaller and more frequent meals during the day compared to eating big meals during the day. And in the scientific literature, there is a discrepancy in the result for studies assessing the effect of eating frequency on health. And there is particularly a discrepancy in regarding the effect on appetite control. We were also interested in this question because the advice to eat smaller and more frequent meals is often given to people on website or health guidelines, but this advice is given despite the lack of clear scientific evidence.
How did you go about your study and with what outcome?
We ran this study with 20 normal weight young men, and what we observed is that when the subject increased their eating frequency. They declared being less hungry just before the lunch. They also presented physiological data that reflect lower physiological level of hunger. And we also observed a decrease in energy intake at lunch. We also ran the same study with obese subjects, and what we observed was a bit different, because basically the level of hunger was exactly the same compared to normal weight subject. Physiology was the same, but behavior were different. So it's quite important finding for us to understand that you can have identical physiological differences between two groups of subjects, but the behaviors are different. And the last point is related to metabolism. For these parameters, we found a potential deleterious effect of increasing eating frequency. That means that when you eat a meal, you have diet-induced thermogenesis. That means that you have an energy expenditure that is due to the meal that you have eaten. And when we compare the breakfast eaten in one intake and compared to the breakfast eaten in four intakes, we observe a decrease in diet-induced thermogenesis for the breakfast eaten in four intakes. That means a decrease in energy expenditure.
Do your findings offer a new solution for weight management?
I'm not sure that it will be a solution for obese people to lose weight, to eat more frequent meals during the day. I think it could help to better control appetite and maybe to change behaviors, but our study assessed the very short-term effect, and I strongly believe that long-term studies are needed in order to go further, and maybe more a study like an intervention study in order to see the effect in the long run.
Neil King from Queensland University of Technology in Brisbane, Australia, tested a novel approach to restricting energy intake for weight loss. He explains.
The rationale and background for this study was that we're aware that the actual weight loss with any energy balance intervention is lower than predicted. So people tend to lose less weight than we would predict. Dietary restriction or energy restriction is a common method for losing weight. And in this study, we used a novel intermittent dietary restriction approach. Typically, energy restriction is what we call a continuous restriction, where people consecutive days will restrict their food intake. So in this study, we took a group of obese men, approximately BMI of about 33, and there were 41 participants. They were divided into one of two groups. The first group was a continuous energy restriction, where they underwent 16 weeks of energy restriction at 67% of their total daily energy requirements. The other group was an intermittent group, in which they still underwent 67% of their total daily energy requirements. However, they underwent an alternate intermittent diet restriction, which was 2 weeks on and 2 weeks off. So they had 2 weeks of energy restriction, followed by 2 weeks of energy balance. All participants' food was provided. It was a prescribed diet. The diet was prescribed based on their measured individual resting metabolic requirements and their physical activity level. The food was supplied to their homes at the beginning of each week, and it was labelled in terms of day and also meal, breakfast, lunch, dinner and snacks. It's important to note that both groups, although in the intermittent group the total duration of their energy restriction was over 30 weeks, the actual energy restriction was only 16 weeks. So both groups were exposed to exactly the same energy deficit. Now, it's important to make that clear.
Simply reducing energy intake often is not successful, especially in the long run, as people tend to regain any pounds lost. Do we know the reasons for this?
This study is part of a large study looking at the compensatory or adaptive responses to energy restriction. We believe that one of the reasons that people will lose less weight than predicted will be they will compensate for the energy deficit. We acknowledge that some people will lose less weight than predicted because of the compliance. They may not comply with the diet or even the exercise prescription. But in this study, the dietary prescription was clamped and individually tailored to each person. So the whole project is looking at barriers, adaptive responses that might explain why some people lose less weight than predicted. So we're looking at resting metabolic rate, non-exercise activity thermogenesis, the exercise economy, that's the energy expenditure of movement, dietary-induced thermogenesis. But the focus of this presentation and abstract was the appetite responses. We know very well that, eating behavior is a strong contributor to body weight. We also know that if you take energy out of individual meal, there is a strong response in their hunger and food intake. So it's possible that if you induce an energy deficit and therefore weight loss, the body will respond by increasing its hunger and food intake. So this presentation was more to do with the food intake and the appetite responses.
And what are the key findings from your research?
There were two really main findings in this study that we presented in this abstract. The first is that the intermittent group lost significantly more weight than the continuous group. So despite being exposed to the same energy deficit over a period of 16 weeks, the intermittent group lost about 12% of their body weight, and it was about 7% in the continuous group. And that difference was significant. So I guess the question is, what's explaining the difference between those two groups? If we look at, first of all, the hunger response, what we showed is that their fasting hunger, and their fasting hunger is measured immediately in the morning after a 12-hour fast, we showed that their fasting hunger in the continuous group was elevated. And this is typical. When individuals lose weight, we see an increase in hunger. So halfway through the energy restriction at 8 weeks and at 16 weeks, the continuous energy restriction group increased their hunger. What was surprising was that in the intermittent group, the hunger was suppressed. So what looks like happening is that there are two main phenomena happening. Firstly, that the intermittent group are not just losing more weight than the continuous group, they're also not experiencing the increase in hunger that's typically seen with weight loss. Now, it's very difficult at this stage because there are other variables that still need to come into the analysis. So it's very difficult to put the whole picture together. But in essence, what these data suggest is that, first of all, intermittent energy restriction might be a more effective way of losing weight, but it also might be more tolerable and increase compliance because the individuals are not experiencing that hunger or that nagging drive to increase their food intake.
It seems that body composition is another key factor in eating behaviour. Graham Finlayson is a researcher from the University of Leeds who's examined this relationship in people who are overweight and obese. Can you tell us what you've found from your research?
So we have an ongoing research program which involves an exercise intervention, and our subjects are enrolled in a 12-week supervised program of physical activity, and we measure their eating behavior in experimental probe day sessions. So we provide all their food for the day, and we measure their sensations of appetite and their sort of hedonic states and their sort of interaction with the food. So we found that different components of our participants' body composition were related to different aspects of their eating behaviour. So their fat-free mass was related to component or aspects of orexigenic drive to eat. So it was related to their sensations of hunger. So the more fat-free mass they had, the greater the tendency they had to feel hungry over the day. And fat-free mass was also related to the size of the meals that they chose to eat, and it was related to their overall energy intake within a day. We found, on the other hand, that their levels of fat mass were associated with different types of behavioural marker, specifically to do with hedonic interaction with food. So the higher the level of fat mass that the participants had, then the more was their tendency to choose and to respond to high fat and high sweet types of food. And the stronger was their scores on hedonic traits like food cravings, binge eating, and disinhibition. So the different aspects of body composition seem to be related to different types of eating behaviour.
If a higher fat-free mass drives hunger, would this not make it more difficult to manage food intake and body weight?
It's a good question. In fact, that's not the case, because it seems to be that the more fat-free mass seems to be a good marker for the overall sensitivity of the appetite system. So while it's related to increased levels of hunger, I think it's also associated with a greater sort of satiety response to food. as well. So people are just more sensitive to internal cues and internal signalling of hunger and satiety. Fat mass seems to be more related to a weaker level of appetite control and more problems with controlling food intake.
What are the implications of this study for weight management?
One of the contributions of this study is to make people more aware of the sort of components of the body composition. So to think beyond just body weight and to think beyond measures such as body mass index, because that doesn't seem to be a very good indicator or a very good marker of eating behaviour.
For some, managing body weight is also a matter of actively controlling food intake. And loss of control may result in excess intake, known as binge eating. Caroline Bratt, a professor in psychology from Ghent University, has studied the link between binge eating and weight gain. She explains.
So the topic of my lecture was the question if it's possible that weight induces binge eating or is it binge eating that induces weight? So that was the big question. And we did some studies where we could find at least some of the answers. And it's rather complicated. A, you have some people, and it can be children or adults, that have problems with their eating and that become overweight because of bad eating habits. But it's also the other pathway is possible that if you have a weight problem or you at least you feel overweight, then you have a lot of concerns about eating and this can induce diet restriction. And because most people then were too strict for themselves, they have a lot of rules on dieting. They have breakdowns, and this breakdown is, for example, when you are emotional or when you are very hungry, and then the eating problems are only a consequence of the overweight. So at least we need to differentiate also in people, in studies, for different subtypes. We could find three groups. So you have overweight people who have no eating problems at all. Then you have a group who shows strict diet restraint attitudes. They think they were doing it very well. Sometimes they skip breakfast, they skip meals, but then paradoxically they have a lot of hunger and then they have binge eating problems. And then there is a third group who have no diet at all, but who sometimes eat because they were very emotional. So the advices we gave to all people, specifically for obese people, also for professionals, is that the first thing you have to do is to see which type you are. Some people, it can be normal weight people or overweight people, can have good days where they can follow a very healthy diet. They can have also bad days. And then the question is, do we have here eating problems or not? One of the characteristics is that you have at least a feeling that you eat too much, so that you have a large amount of food. But also, very important is that you could not stop. If you think, well, it was a party and I eat too much, but it's because just of the social situation, then it's not a problem. But if you eat too much because you lost your control over eating, then you have a problem, and then you can do two things.
Lien Goossens, who is a postdoctoral researcher in the group of Professor Bratt, goes on to explain.
An important symptom is the loss of control over eating, where the children or the youngsters have the feelings they cannot stop eating or they cannot control their eating. And we have found that this symptom, which is in fact an eating disorder symptom, is already present in young children. So for example, in elementary school aged children, we have found prevalence rates about 20% of the children who report at least one episode of loss of control over the last month, and also in adolescents. Lessons, comparable prevalence rates of loss of control are found. Now, this eating disorder symptom may predict worse eating disorder outcome, so it is important for practice that to prevent eating disorders or obesity, to prevent that the loss of control is going worse or that more episodes of loss of control will be reported. Now, two important mechanisms are related to the development of loss of control. The first one is dieting. So when you follow a strict diet, this may have counter or counterproductive effects. So dieting is not always leading to weight loss, but in fact, when you are hungry or when you feel emotionally, dieting may cause binge eating or may cause loss of control over eating. So in that case, we recommend that people stop dieting because it has more negative effects than it has positive effects, especially the strict dieting where you, for example, exclude all sweets from your eating habits. So this dieting mechanism is the first one. Another important mechanism is the mechanism of regulating negative emotions. So binge eating or loss of control eating can also be where people use this mechanism to regulate negative emotions. So they use emotional eating as a way to gain positive emotions, for example, when they are depressed or when they feel tired or when they feel ignored by someone. And this emotional eating can cause loss of control and can also be important or play an important role in the development of eating disorders and obesity later on. So for people who experience a loss of control as a consequence of their emotional eating, we would recommend that they go to a psychologist, because no dieting has to do with this mechanism, but in psychotherapy you can learn to use more adaptive emotional regulation strategies instead of using eating as a way to regulate your emotions, because that will lead to overeating and to more loss of control.
As well as the behavioural aspects of appetite and food intake control, there's evidence that different diets have different physiological effects on satiety. Wim Saris, professor in human nutrition at Maastricht University in the Netherlands, talks about the results of the Diet, Obesity and Genes Project, or Diogenes, which showed how a high-protein diet can help in weight maintenance. Can you tell us more about the Diogenes Project?
Diogenes was one of the biggest obesity-related EU projects in the past years. And I have talked a little bit about the outcome, and especially about the dietary intervention, where we focused on protein intake and the glycemic index of diet in relation to weight maintenance. In the Diogenes Project, the dietary intervention, which was an intervention in 8 centers in Europe with about 800-900 people, we first reduced body weight in overweight and obese adults with about 10 to 12 kilograms, because afterwards they are more sensitive for weight regain. And then we followed them for half a year with different diets, with high or low protein content and high or low glycemic index. So we had 4 groups and then a control group. The outcome was quite clear that the high protein, low glycemic index diet is the most effective one, talking about weight maintenance. And in fact, that group with high protein, low glycemic index really maintained the body weight loss, which is surprisingly, because mostly if you lose quite a lot of weight, you regain it also quite rapidly again. And that was true in most of the other groups, but not in the high protein, low glycemic group.
The Diogenes Project also looked at the genetic factors behind weight maintenance. How important are genes when it comes to controlling body weight?
So far, I must say that the genetic influence is minor compared to the dietary influence. And this is not the first time we see that. We did other studies, the Nugunov European studies with nutrition gene interaction in obesity, also showed clearly that the type of diet, so let's say high fat or high carbohydrate, it's much more of importance than a genetic background.
A relatively new branch of research into diet and obesity is focused on the gut microbiota. This refers to the bacterial makeup of our digestive systems, which is known to have an important influence on human health. Christen Verbeke is a professor at the Department of Gastroenterology at the Catholic Universiteit in Leuven, Belgium. She describes the relationship between the gut microbiota and overall human health.
It is a friendly living together, and it is a symbiotic relationship. So that means that both parties benefit from this relationship. We need the bacteria, and then the bacteria need the host. So the host provides the bacteria with a stable environment, with an anaerobic environment, with sufficient nutrients, so that they can use, that it is warm in the gut, so they have a stable and nice place to live. And the bacteria provide us with some substrates, some metabolites, vitamins also, for example, that we do not have to produce ourselves and that we can use. So both parties benefit from this relationship. And optimal gut health is not only important for your gut, but also for the whole human system.
What's the link between microbiota composition and obesity?
Particularly in relationship to obesity, it has been shown that the microbiota composition is important and that microbiota composition differs in obese subjects as compared to lean, let's say, normal subjects or subjects with a normal BMI. And that is something quite new, that this microbiota can also influence not only the local processes that occur within the large intestine, within the colon, but also they can influence our systemic or overall health. At this moment, it is also not completely elucidated whether this altered microbiota composition in obesity is the cause of the obesity or is the consequence of the obesity. What we also do not know is how the ideal microbiota should look. We can say that there are differences between mean obese subjects and mean lean subjects, but there is not a clear definition of what is a healthy microbiota composition. And so it is still also not so easy to know in what way you have to change your microbiota. We are nowadays really learning very much about the composition and the activity of the bacteria that live in our gut, and that will help us to make strategies to treat diseases or disorders like obesity.
What are the factors regulating microbiota composition?
The factors that regulate the microbiota composition are first of all the diet composition, because microbiota need undigested food remnants as a kind of energy for themselves. So they need food, and by changing the diet you can change the composition of the microbiota. And two important strategies to change the microbiota is the use of, on the one side, prebiotics, which are undigested carbohydrates that then serve as a food for the microbiota, or the administration of probiotics, which are live bacteria that you administer and of which you hope they will be able to survive in the colon, in the large intestine, and to increase their numbers and to colonize, actually, the colon.
We've known for many years that bacteria live in our gut. Why do we only now get a better understanding of their composition?
What we know at this time about the microbiota has mainly come by significant improvements in technology to analyze the microbiota, because years ago the colon was considered as a black box. We did not know what was happening inside, and it is due to recent techniques and recent advancements and technologies that we have been able to analyze the composition of the microbiota. Many of the bacteria that live in the colon cannot be cultured in the lab, and culturing was previously the only way to analyze bacteria. And it is with the advent of new technologies that are not based on culturing anymore, but that are based on molecular techniques, that we can now decipher which bacteria live there, which ones are important, which ones are less important, and things like that.
Nathalie Delzen, Professor of Nutrition and Metabolism at the Université Catholique de Louvain, agrees that the food we eat has important effects on gut microbiota.
Well, I'm working for years now on the role of specific components of the diet that may have an effect on health. And more specifically, I'm really interested with my research group just to work on the way by which nutrients, it means the food components, may interact with the gut microbiota. So it means the hundreds of billions of bacteria inside our gut promote health and to have impact on health. We are living in perfect dialogue and symbiosis with those hundreds of billions of bacteria, and we have to give them food. And the way we are nourishing those bacteria is very important. The dietary fibers present in fruit, vegetables and cereals are quite important and considered as important nutrients in food, for sure. And that's because they have a lot of effects. What has been a little bit forgotten, I would say, for years, is the fact that some dietary fibers, some carbohydrates, which are not digested by ourselves, can be used as substrates by bacteria. So we can finally feed the bacteria by eating food and nutrients which are non-digested, such as the dietary fibers. For example, bifidobacteria are able, in collaboration with other bacteria in the gut, to use non-digestible oligosaccharides, more specifically. For example, fructooligosaccharides have been described as the first one to be used more specifically by bifidobacteria. And so it's a nutritional way to increase the level of bifidobacteria.
Is further research needed in this area?
Yes, for sure. As soon as we have an idea of the relevance of physiological effect of dietary fibers, we have also to have fundamental research to know, okay, are there some interesting effect of some dietary fibers that could be attributed to the impact on the gut microbiota? How does it work? Which are the targets? How is the dialogue between those thousands of billions of bacteria and our own cells? So this research must be done.
There is growing evidence that carbohydrates are vital for a healthy digestive system. Harry Flint works at the Rowett Research Institute, which is part of the University of Aberdeen in Scotland. He talks to UFIC about the detrimental effect carbohydrate diets can have on gut function.
We've done a couple of studies where we took two reduced levels of carbohydrate in diets that we gave to obese people. These were Atkins-type diets. They had elevated protein in them, which helps to produce satiety. But what we were interested in was to see how these diets affected the gut microbiota and the metabolites that they produced. And we're really wanting to know whether there was any potential problem with changes in gut environment that might increase the risk, for example, of colorectal cancer. So what we found is, first of all, there's a disproportionate drop in butyric acid, which is quite an important bacterial product that helps to protect against cancer in the bowel. But also we had saw some other changes. We saw a considerable drop in certain phenolic compounds from dietary fiber, like ferulic acid, which is also considered to be protective. This is on the low-carb diets. And finally, we saw an increase in TROSA compounds, and these come from protein through microbial action or direct action. And some of those are known to be carcinogenic, so they actually promote cancer. So in general, we felt that the more extreme diets over a very long period could elevate people's risk of colorectal cancer.
What do we know about the importance of fiber for gut health?
Well, I think we're still working towards that, in the sense that it's fairly clear that we need some form of fiber in the diet. But the real question is, what type of fiber? And do you also need resistant starch, which also, like plant fiber, survives through to the large intestine? And I think in another study that we did recently, we showed that high resistant starch and high plant fiber have rather different effects on the gut microbiota and on metabolites, and probably we're going to conclude that a combination of the two would be beneficial, because they confer rather different health benefits. So the plant fiber releases these phenolic compounds, whereas resistant starch is very good at stimulating butyrate production. So probably both together, but we don't have definitive evidence on it.
Inga Björk, professor of applied nutrition at Lund University in Sweden, has done research investigating the effect of what she calls intact foods on blood glucose and appetite. Here she explains more about her research.
What we did was to provide healthy humans with different common foods in the evening. And what was particular with these foods were that they were within more or less intact botanical structure. They were either boiled barley kernels or bread made with appreciable portion of barley kernels, a pump and nickel type bread. Or the foods given in the evening were, for instance, brown beans, regular foods. And what we found was that if we provide healthy humans with these more or less intact foods in the evening, we are able to beneficially influence blood glucose regulation, appetite regulating hormones, in a way that we are able to decrease hunger promoting hormones and increase satiety hormones, and also affect the voluntary intake, lower the voluntary intake during the course of the entire next day, while at the same time promoting less hunger, which is quite useful for an obese population. So we interpret these data as an important food feature to be aware of when it comes to preventing obesity and the metabolic syndrome.
Based on these results, what would you recommend people to eat for better weight management?
I certainly would advise them to eat foods that are richer in dietary fiber, which is a common feature among consumers. But in fact, there is reason to believe that any indigestible carbohydrates in foods, and in particular, if present in sufficient amount and perhaps also in a certain mixture, that is beneficial for satiety and glycemic regulation.
Alessandro Vigiano from the Second University of Naples in Italy has worked on an educational tool for promoting good nutrition and physical activity among school-age children. He talked to Yufik about this tool called Kaleido and its implications for obesity prevention.
Kaleido is a board game. Basically, it's a game in which the guys are collecting collecting cards that represent normal daily food in the Mediterranean diet. Together with that, he has also the possibility to collect some cards that represent physical activity. At the end of the game, the winner is the player who will balance better the food intake with the physical activity to get zero for this value. It is a game that took no more than 15-30 minutes for playing, and it is very interesting since, as I had told, it's not a question-answering game, but it is really a funny game and who promote also social interaction between children. We tested the game in middle school and in high school. That means we had a range of players that was between 9 and 19 years old. Mostly they were, the biggest group were from the middle school. We tested the children through two questionnaires. One is called Adolescent Food Health Checklist from the study of Johnson, and the other one is a dietary questionnaire from Turconi. What we noted was an improvement in all the parts of the questionnaire that tested for nutrition knowledge, for healthy choices, and self-reported physical activity. Moreover, we measure the weight and the height of all the students at the same time. We noted an impressive result that is these children reduced their weight at 6 and then 18 months, and we had a reduction in the number of obese and overweight children.
As well as preventing obesity through education, researchers are working to identify molecular targets that could be used for treating obesity and metabolic disease. Florian Kiefer won the Young Investigator Award for Best PhD Thesis in the Field of Obesity Research at ECO 2012. Specifically, he looked at the protein osteopontin and its role in obesity. Dr. Kiefer, can you tell us a bit more about this protein?
Osteopontin is an inflammatory protein that has been discovered before in other inflammatory diseases such as atherosclerosis and rheumatoid arthritis, but nobody has ever looked at the role of osteopontin in obesity-induced inflammation. So we found that this protein osteopontin is highly upregulated in adipose tissue of obese mice and humans, and when we knocked this protein out in mice, they couldn't produce the protein anymore. And when we put these mice on a high-fat diet, they became obese. And when we then looked at the adipose tissue, we found that these mice had reduced inflammation, reduced accumulation of inflammatory cells, such as macrophages. When we then looked at other tissues, such as the liver, we found that all that inflammation was also reduced in this tissue. And so the overall conclusion of this project was that osteopontin
is highly increased with obesity in adipose tissue and in the liver, and it mediates obesity-induced inflammation and insulin resistance. And that targeting osteopontin in obesity could be a novel therapeutic approach in metabolic disease.
What can you tell us about the award presentation?
It was a great honor for me to stand there and present my thesis work to such a distinguished audience, and I really appreciate the invitation, and I'd like to thank the organizers and the Young Investigator United Board for giving me this opportunity.
These talks have highlighted some of the key topics in obesity research today. We've seen how there are significant differences in eating and appetite behavior between people of a normal weight and those who are obese. The effect of different foods on weight management, and especially on the health of our gut microbiota, has also emerged as an important and fast-developing area of obesity research. Food Today. Science-based information on food, nutrition and safety. From UFIC, the European Food Information Council.